The second case set for oral argument this morning is appeal number 30859, Jody Pham versus Smithfield Foods. Laura Hensley is present, will be arguing on behalf of Smithfield Foods, the appellant, and David King will be arguing on behalf of Ms. Pham, and Brendan Pons is also present. All right, Ms. Hensley, you can proceed with your argument, and you can take a drink if you want. Oh, sorry. We've got it. I forget to do this. Judge Dave Kanoff is sitting with us for First Circuit Judge in place of Justice Kern. I think the parties get notice of that, don't you?
Yep.
Yeah. So appreciate Judge Kanoff sitting with us this morning. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Laura Hensley, and I represent the appellant Smithfield Foods regarding their appeal from the Circuit Court's reversal of the Department of Labor's decision. Smithfield respectfully requests that this court reverse the holding of the Circuit Court and affirm the finding of the Department of Labor, finding in Smithfield's favor. The issues before this court center around three main arguments from my perspective. First, whether the Circuit Court erred in raising and deciding an issue that was not raised by the parties. Second, whether the Circuit Court erred in holding that SDCL 627-33 places the burden on Smithfield to show that claimant was not entitled to benefits. And third, whether the department erred in finding that claimant failed to sustain her burden of proof to establish that the work activities were a major contributing cause to her condition and need for treatment. As it relates to the first issue, during the administrative proceedings and in the Circuit Court proceedings, neither party disputed that claimant had the burden to establish entitlement to benefits, nor was that 627-33 ever argued in front of the Circuit Court. The Circuit Court reversed the department on grounds that were never raised by the parties and sua sponte, held that 627-33 places the burden on Smithfield to show that claimant was not entitled to workers' compensation benefits. The Circuit Court found that the department plainly erred, requiring claimant to show that she was entitled to benefits, and that this error would require a reversal and a remand to the department for a redetermination of the evidence.
So in the at the department level, seems right. I agree with you. There's no mention of 33 statute. The petition doesn't really talk one way or the other so much about burden shifting, but it's the petition that starts the proceeding. In the post-hearing briefs, it seems like there's a reference there to not the 33 statute and not really the 33 concept, but kind of a burden shifting concept in sort of tying into that excerpt from Hansen, it's the construction company.
62-4.
Yeah. So that Hansen case, that sort of that idea that it's that standard of proper and reasonable and necessary and that sort of thing. And that's different than the 33 argument, burden shifting argument, yes?
Yes, Your Honor. Smithfield is not asserting that any of the treatment rendered to Ms. Pham was unreasonable, improper.
And do you think that Hansen relates to a 62-4-1 sort of interpretation more so than causation? Is that what you're saying?
Correct. Yeah. I think causation and whether the treatment is unreasonable, unnecessary, or improper are two different analysis to take place. And I think that the Circuit Court conflated the two and confused them, and in doing so, improperly placed the burden on Smithfield.
It seems like the principal premise upon which your argument rests, at least as far as this part of the argument, is that when an employer pays workers' compensation benefits, here it looked like it was mostly medical benefits, and then there was impairment rating at the end of maximum medical improvement.
Correct.
Or whatever. But it's the premise that by doing that, in something that's otherwise not litigated or adjudicated even by consent, that the employer's not accepting or acknowledging or acquiescing in causation. Is that fair? That's a premise that underlies your argument. Just because you pay doesn't mean you're foreclosed from at some point saying, no, now it's time for you to prove causation.
Correct, Your Honor. And I think that that's consistent with this court's application of the statutes.
Well, tell us about that. What's the legal support that underlies that?
So I would say that the two cases on this issue that I believe are instructive are Martz, which was issued in 2014. And in that case, which was, I believe, authored by Justice Zinter, the Martz argued that it was a promissory estoppel case. Martz argued that this insurance company has been paying benefits from 2005 to 2009, and that now to stop paying benefits, it's unfair, essentially, to the claimant in that situation.
Martz seems like a result, though, more than a rule. Martz didn't seem to, and maybe I didn't read it very closely, or should read more closely. If I'm missing it in your view, let me know. But Martz seems like a result. Martz seems like it doesn't foreclose the concept of promissory estoppel. It just didn't work in that case.
I don't disagree necessarily, Your Honor. What I think was important in that case is when Justice Zinter noted that employers and insurers have an obligation to pay claims promptly, and that obligation would be adversely affected if paying claims precluded the later denial of liability when sufficient medical evidence develops to justify a denial. And the other case that I was going to point you to on this issue is the Hayes case, Hayes v. Rosenbaum Signs, another case from 2014. And in that case, the distinction was that there was a judicial acceptance of an admission by the employer and insurer in a pleading. So there was, you know, employer and insurer denied some benefits. Upon the deposition testimony, I believe, of Dr. Anderson, they decided to change their opinion and judicially or amend their answer, which was then judicially accepted. And in that case, later on, the insurance company got an independent medical evaluation and denied the claim. And on appeal, this court said, you are judicially stopped from changing your position because there was an admission by you that was judicially accepted by the court. So therefore, your only avenue to deny benefits thereafter is to file a petition for hearing with the department pursuant to 62733.
But regardless, I'm not sure we really have an estoppel theory here anyway.
In my case?
In this one.
Correct, Your Honor. And that's not, I agree. Smithfield takes no issue. I don't have an issue with the holding in Hayes. I don't think that the reversing the circuit court in this case does not require reversing the court in Hayes or in Martz. In this case, you know, Smithfield paid benefits for a period of time. I think it was around March of 2018 when the Jody Pham's medical providers were no longer causally connecting the work activities to the current condition, at which point in time Smithfield suspended benefits. And so there was never a judicial admission, or there was never an admission by Smithfield. There was never a judicial acceptance of an admission by Smithfield. Therefore, it was within Smithfield's rights to terminate benefits.
So in your view, absent some sort of an adjudication of causation or some sort of an admission by the employer of causation, doesn't matter how long that employer pays benefits, causation's always at issue under South Dakota statutes, and it's always the employee's burden.
I agree, Your Honor. Yes, I think that it remains the employee's burden to establish that the current condition is the work activities remain a major contributing cause of the current condition and need for treatment. Now, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and at the point that an employer under that scenario would, at any point, but at the point, I should say, where the employer says, yeah, at this point, we're out, we're done, your argument is then that's when the 62735.1 statute comes into focus, right? And that's that triggers the statute of limitations. The statutory text itself, your argument is, seems to suggest there has been preceding payments that have happened without any kind of adjudication because it's a statute of limitations statute.
Correct, Your Honor. So if in certain situations, employers and insurers will issue a denial, which obviously implicates 62735. In other situations, they pay benefits for a period of time, and benefits are suspended without a written denial being issued. And then 62735.1 allows 3 years from the last payment of benefits for a claimant to come forward and file a petition for hearing with the department. Now, I don't think My argument, I think, in my brief was that 627.35.1 is superfluous if 627.33 is the only avenue by which an employer and insurer can come back and request to deny benefits.
Which one's superfluous?
I think that 627.35.1 would be superfluous if the only way to terminate benefits would be filing a petition for hearing with the Department of Labor pursuant to 627.33. And, you know, and to answer your question, Chief Justice, your comment, I think that the burden...
It was really a question.
Okay, so the burden does... I don't believe that the burden does shift to Smithfield or employers and insurers unless there's an order declaring the issue that is resolved, for instance, what happened in the Fern Johnson, the UPS case, or there's a judicial admission that is made, like that happened in the Hayes case. Short of that, I think our case... I mean, there's... I didn't pull it. I won't say that I did. One of my associates pulled all the cases that you have all heard from last decade. And of those 52 cases that involved workers' compensation, 18 of them included cases where an employer and insurer denied benefits following initial payment of those benefits. In none of those cases did this court hold that an employer and insurer are required to file a petition for hearing pursuant to 627.33 prior to terminating those benefits, with the exception of the Hayes case, where there was already an admission and a judicial acceptance of that admission.
Can you turn to the argument, assuming that there did have to be a causation showing by the claimant here, whether, if we're reviewing now the department's determination, whether that was clear error?
So as it relates to the Dr. Ripperdow versus Dr. Jensen?
Yes.
Is that what you're referring to? Thank you, Your Honor. So in that situation, I agree that, well, I think we briefed this after the second oral argument, perhaps with Judge Hoffman, but that the deposition testimony of Dr. Ripperdow was via video, and that was allowed to be reviewed via clear error. So it was both Dr. Jensen, who testified live, Dr. Ripperdow, who came in via video deposition, and the department ultimately heard both and found that because Dr. Ripperdow did not review the entirety of claimant's medical history and records, because he did not evaluate her job or see a video of what she was doing at Smithfield, and because Dr. Jensen did do those things, he reviewed all 1,400 plus pages of her records, he reviewed a video of her job, and identified that there was no stressors he could find in the job that she did that would cause all of the conditions from which she complained. And the department highlighted the MRI from January 2016, which showed no herniation. So that was roughly, I think the injury was in October of 2015. A couple of months later, there was no herniation. And then several months later, I believe 18 months later, there was a herniation. So Dr. Jensen was focusing on the fact that if the work injury actually caused this cervical condition, there would have been something present at that time. And that was important to the department in their analysis, in the analysis finding in favor of Smithfield. And ultimately, the department found that Dr. Jensen's opinion was just more persuasive than that of Dr. Ripperdow based on his full review of the records. And I think, from my recollection, Dr. Ripperdow's opinion was not very well explained. Although he connected all of the conditions, it was just that. It was just a connection without an explanation.
Dr. Ripperdow testified by video deposition. Our rules say we review paper depositions. We don't give any deference to agency findings or circuit court's agency findings on those. Video deposition different?
That was ultimately briefed by the parties and determined to be different, that the video deposition afforded the department an opportunity to evaluate the credibility of the testifying doctor. That was an issue that was separately briefed by the parties at the request of Judge Hoffman, and that was ultimately what the conclusion was also in Judge Hoffman's memorandum and decision issued in June. And so ultimately, I think that it should be reviewed under the clear error standard, Your Honor. And I also wanted to point out that there are some significant public policy considerations here, because if the circuit court decision is upheld, I think that what Justice Center was afraid of happening in March is exactly what will happen. There won't be a prompt payment of benefits by insurance companies, and insurance companies will deny, or primarily deny, to avoid looking, being on the hook into perpetuity, or to avoid having to, you know, if they pay one bill, that's what this is saying. If they pay one bill, then you have to go to the Department of Labor then to seek permission to deny benefits thereafter pursuant to 62733. That cannot be the status of the law. I mean, what that will do is cause unnecessary litigation. The claimants will be giving up 25% of their benefits by hiring a lawyer to represent them in those situations. And our one Department of Labor judge probably won't appreciate all the enormous amount of petitions that will be filed as a result of such a policy. And frankly, I'd be afraid that there would be insurance companies that would pull out of the market entirely, which would cause significant impact to the employers around our state and increase in premiums. And our current system does not punish an employer for making a prompt payment of benefits while continuing their investigation, and I ask that this court uphold that precedent. Thank you.
Mr. King, you can proceed with our argument.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. I represent Jody Pham. Jody Pham was injured in 2015 while working at John Morrell Smithfield. She'd been there for many years, doing the same job repetitively, over and over. On October 14th, 2015, they take her to occupational medicine. She is seen by Dr. Elkins. Dr. Elkins says she's got this shoulder, she's got this neck involvement. We need physical therapy, and he refers her to physical therapy. Later on, Dr. Noonan from the same occupational medicine is involved in her care. Dr. Noonan refers her to Dr. Ashvahani for evaluation of surgery. Dr. Ashvahani refers her to Dr. Ripperda. Dr. Ripperda refers her to Dr. Sheikh, Dr. Liddell, Dr. Pudens, all in the chain of referrals. Every condition is accepted and paid for several years, and I heard today they stopped paying it in March of 2018. But if you look at their actual pay screen, which is part of the settled record, you will see that they made payments after that date, including to Dr. Liddell, who is treating the shoulder. And I'm referring to pages 1803 and 1806 of this settled record. Payments to Avera McKinnon, payments to Core Orthopedics, payments to Jody Pham, to Avera Physical Medicine and Rehab. Years go by. Jody Pham was born and raised in Vietnam. English is the second language for Ms. Pham. She's slightly built. She is smaller physically than me. Doing this same job, which she started in the 90s, over and over again. So Dr. Ripperda gets involved. Smithfield accepted and paid every single one of those conditions, every single one. There is no, they have no basis on which to deny any benefit. One of the great different
question, though, that they have no basis to deny benefiters, the question is they have no legal obligation to continue paying. And in going sort of at that inquiry, don't we then get at the heart of this first issue, which relates to the burden of proof Whether it's here, whether that argument's preserved, and if it is, who's got the burden?
Sure. Yes, the argument is preserved. It was briefed to the department. You can look right at the briefs.
There was a burden-shifting argument. I would agree with you on that. But it was that Hansen versus Penrod construction,
yes,
one, sort of what I call sort of a 62-4 statutory argument. But the 33 argument, the employer-employee request for review of benefits argument, it doesn't look like that came up at all in proceedings before the department or the circuit court up until the circuit court issued its decision. Is that right?
I think as time went on, like in many cases, the briefs got sharper and sharper. But we clearly argued that Hansen versus Penrod, they have no right to interfere with any treatment. The authorized and accepted treating physician, which in this case was Dr. Ripperda, that is the person that makes the calls.
So it's a different standard, though. And the reason why the 33 burden-shifting argument seems to differ from the Hansen one is that the standard under Hansen and the operative part that you're really have been highlighting throughout the all stages of the case is this preeminence that treating doctors have when determining the necessity, the suitability, and the propriety of the care. But doesn't that presume, again, an obligation to be responsible for the care? In other words, that standard, is this care necessary, is it suitable, is it proper, is not the same standard as is the employment a major contributing cause of the current need for treatment.
Right. They seem different. Two different things.
Yeah. So this one I see 62-4-1 throughout the case. 33 comes in later, and they seem different. Am I wrong? Can you reconcile them?
Yeah.
Or do you?
I'd love to reconcile them. When you look at 62-7-33, the very first thing it says is any payment. It doesn't say final payment. It says any payment. But then it gets worse for this finality argument. Including medical payments under 62-4-1, which was your argument, medical payments, and disability payments under 62-4-3, which are TTD benefits. So manifestly, that does not mean a final award. The statute itself talks about temporary benefits and ongoing medical treatment, not a final award. In fact, you won't find final award in that statute.
You do have language, though, any payment made or to be made. So made or to be made, I suppose you could sort of infer from that a compulsory obligation to make or to be made. So these are payments for which, these are payments for which being made or to be made is a foregone conclusion. It's done. It's established. And this statute seems to be authorizing, again, not causation or anything like that, but this statute seems to be authorizing a review at the behest of either person.
Yes.
By the way, it could be
yes.
The employer or it could be the employee.
Yes.
And it seems to be turning on a change of conditions. So
yes.
When I look at what we've got here, I don't see that anyone ever really wanted to review anything. I don't know that they were payments that were obligated to be made, and I don't see that this ties into the change of conditions statute, but maybe you disagree.
I do. And keep in mind, they had no medical basis to disagree till they got Jensen's opinion over 4 years later. That's the first time they had any.
But hang in there with the 33 statute. Tell me about that text, though. Tell me about that text. Tell me, if you would, what your argument is as far as made or to be made and whether that in.
If they want to stop payments to Ms. Pham for care that they've already authorized through Dr. Ripperda, they, under Hansen versus Penrod and that line of cases, they don't have the right to. They have to go back to court, and they have the burden. And we kept saying the whole way through.
What legal authority is there that says, having made these payments, they are obligated for an indefinite period of time to continue making them unless they're relieved of that obligation under the 33 statute? What is the basis for their obligation to continue paying?
It's from 6241, right?
So suitability, reasonable necessity, suitability, and propriety.
The employee makes the original selection of the treating physician. Jody didn't really get that chance in this case, but she acquiesced to the treatment, right? And ultimately, Dr. Ripperda becomes her treating doctor. And by the way, he makes these causation decisions during the 13 times that he's treating her. Judge Faw found that Dr. Jensen's opinion was more persuasive. She didn't find one person not credible. She said more persuasive. That was based on a review of the MRIs.
Do you agree that that question, by the way, do you agree that, that's reviewed for clear error?
In other words,
yeah.
Yeah. And I think it is clear error because Dr. Jensen pinned everything on the March 2014 prior complaint of shoulder. But he clearly never read the record. Because if he would have read the record, she went into Dr. Stotz, her family care physician, okay, for her annual checkup. And he checked her women's health issues. And she also told him, hey, my shoulder's hurting from this repetitive work I do at work. So keep in mind, the prior record where they talk about she had shoulder pain is tied to the work.
And did you explore that on cross-examination?
I tried to.
Yeah. So and the reason I ask is this case is a little bit different than some of the cases we get. Sometimes we get cases in the workers' compensation area that are, they're all records. The depositions are all on paper. There's affidavits. There's things like that. And, of course, our standard of review in those cases doesn't allow for any deference. Why would it? Because there's no really quintessential fact-finding going on at the department level. This one's different, it seems. This one is one where everyone seems to agree. There was live testimony. Dr. Jensen, I think, was on a video link.
Yep.
Yeah, and Dr. Ripperda was by video. We know that.
Yep.
So everyone seems to agree this is clear error. That's a lot different in terms of the way we would examine that issue and review it. That would contemplate a great deal of deference. We wouldn't otherwise accord for just a paper review. So this seems different, and we have to be firmly convinced that a mistake has been made.
Well, and you should be thoroughly convinced.
Okay.
Justice Myron has pointed out before, as have many justices, if you're unaware of the prior records, your opinion is only as good as what it's based upon. Jody Pham has treated 39 times at Smithfield by their health services. That's right in the settled record. 39 times she goes in for treatment on the right shoulder. That's in the 2 months before this injury. Dr. Jensen was unaware of any of that. Right? So if Dr. Ripperda was unaware of the one record that related it to work, it sure seems Dr. Jensen, who said he didn't know about this, 39 times in 2 months without a first report of injury.
But his ultimate, but does it really matter? I mean, unlike Dr. Ripperda, who had an opinion favoring compensability, Dr. Jensen didn't think that that the 2015 injury was related. So I guess wouldn't medical records that precede the date of injury support his view that this is not a major contributing cause?
No, because the one record he relies on, the one, ties it to work, from work. He didn't know about this, didn't know that four managers had signed off on it, didn't know that there was a report to OSHA, all in the record. He didn't know about it. By the way, another statute says opinions are supposed to be based on objective medical evidence, right? Statute right on that. He can never explain the abnormal EMG. He can't.
So when we do a de novo review, we're making that assessment. But when it's a clearly erroneous review, we're looking at the, in this case, administrative law judge's decision, and we have to say that there's no support in the record for this. You think that's true here?
I think that facts can be reviewed de novo. I think you can look at the medical record the very same that Judge Baugh can.
But she made findings of fact based on
that it was more persuasive. Yep. And that was based on that one record, and that was also based on his view of the two MRIs. By the way, Dr. Ripperda totally explains the two MRIs. You know, Dr. Jensen's all over the place. It's psychosomatic, must be in her head. He's not a psychiatrist. Dr. Ripperda or nobody else thought it was psychosomatic. Everybody else found causation.
Thank you. Ms. Hensley, you can proceed with rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. At the beginning of Mr. King's oral argument, he told you that my client continued to make payments for a while after March of 2018. I don't dispute that the pay log submitted to the Department of Labor via the Form 107, which is required by all insurance companies every 30 days, would show some payments made by Smithfield. But that is simply because not all of her conditions were denied at that time. The ongoing treatment for some of the conditions, including the ulnar neuropathy in her right arm and later the spinal cord stimulator, were denied because there was no medical support from her treating physicians to establish causation. And that's why Smithfield ultimately ended up denying the benefits. The opinion...
And then you ultimately pay the impairment rating.
Correct, Your Honor. Yeah, and the opinion of Dr. Jensen, there's been this, in the briefing, there's a big to-do about the fact that Dr. Jensen's opinion was not obtained until 4 years after my client initially denied benefits. I'm not disputing that. But Dr. Jensen's opinion was obtained in January of 2022, and for the first time, claimant had an opinion from Dr. Ripperda in February of 2022, causally connecting all of the conditions. It was prior to that Dr. Ripperda did not provide a causation opinion establishing a causal connection between the work injury and the current condition from which Ms. Pham complained. If read the way that claimant is asking you to read it, it means that if I have injured my right hand and all of a sudden I'm complaining of a left knee problem, that's connected just based on the fact that I initially accepted this claim and paid for it, and that I must... then file a petition for hearing with the Department of Labor pursuant to 62733 in order to deny benefits. That's just not the status of our law. And I don't think that Hansen requires, clear that Hansen does not require employer and insurer to file a petition with the Department of Labor. 62733 is not mentioned once in Hansen. 6241 is, and again, as Smithfield contends in our brief, I am not arguing that the treatment provided to her was unnecessary and unsuitable or improper. It was. Dr. Jensen opined that it was. She needed that. The question is it causally connected to the work injury? And the answer to that is no. And the Department of Labor found that after reviewing the record. I agree, again, that there's clear... that the reviewing standard here is clear error. So there must be deference given to the Department of Labor after she heard what ended up being a very long day of testimony.
So I remember in Dr. Jensen's cross-examination, it was last week when I read it. So I remember getting into the OSHA stuff, and I couldn't remember how much of that came in. I know there was objections along the way. But as it relates to this missing record that Mr. King was referencing, I was having a hard time, I should have pulled it up, but I was having a hard time remembering if that was explored on cross-examination. Do you happen to recall?
Whether the health services record were explored?
Yes.
I think that he asked that question, but I don't think the health services records are not a part of the medical records. I will just tell you.
Have them. So are they in there?
They were part of the record. They were not a part of the medical records that were initially sent to Dr. Jensen. What I asked him was, does that change your opinion? And the answer is no. The initial treatment, he received all of the records. Health services at Smithfield is somewhere where you go downstairs, somebody sees you for some ice, some heat, that kind of thing. It was not until after that treatment at Smithfield that a first report of injury was filed, and then treatment was sought outside of Smithfield, which started the whole chain of care thereafter. So it was insignificant to Dr. Jensen what those health services records said, because the initial treatment and diagnostic care that was provided by the providers after the report of injury in October was the information that he used to base his opinion.
So he had an opportunity to know of their existence, either through cross-examination, perhaps your redirect as well, and gave his opinion on where they fit in terms of his analysis.
Yeah.
And all laid bare in front of the ALJ.
Correct. Yeah. And there was a reference by Mr. King that he kept saying that one record is what Dr. Jensen was referring to. I don't know what that means. I don't know what one record. He read all of the records. He read 1,400. He did, and there was a bill that came with it. So
I think he seemed to be referring to the one that where she made a complaint about a shoulder in March of 2014.
Yeah, and Dr. Jensen was not, I mean, it's a totality of the records that he relied on in making his determination to say, I just don't think, and looking at all of these, that I can causally connect her current condition to her work activities. And I'm out of time, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments this morning. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.